I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Years in any career makes it more than just a job, it's a passion. And today we'll meet three actors with more than three decades of experience each, who are now starring together on stage. We'll learn how they got their start, how much the theater and its audiences have changed over the years, and what it's like to make a living as an actor in Kansas City. Then, why does society send people to prison? Is it to punish, or rehabilitate, or protect? With Kansas and Missouri prison populations growing, we'll speak with the author of a recent report who says, we're putting too many people behind bars. Later, Bill Brownlee brings us this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Ask any actor, the stage can be a tough way to make a living. More fail than succeed, and even the successful ones can have long seasons of struggle or get out of the business altogether. But some careers do last, and last, and last. There's a new production in town that features three Kansas City actors who've made it for more than 30 years apiece, and they're here to talk about the show, their careers, and the realities of making it as an actor in this town. Here in our studio this morning are Jan Rogge and David Fritz and Kathleen Warfel. They're all appearing in the Kansas City Actors Theater production of My Old Lady. We'll talk about that show in a minute, but first I want to talk about them. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you all here. So I'm curious how you all got your start in acting. What led you into this business in the first place? Jan Rogge?
Well, early on it was high school.
Yeah.
And then
what were you in high school?
Funny lady, funny girl.
Funny girl. Oh, wow. The Barbara Streisand.
No, I played the mom.
Oh, okay. and that's how you got your start. Did you go into acting right out of college then? Or?
Yeah, then I went to undergrad, and then that's what got me here to Kansas City. I'm from Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
And I went to grad school here in the acting program at UMKC.
Ever any doubt in your mind that acting is what you wanted to do?
No, in fact, this is so, people say this a lot, but actually when I was a child, like between like 6 and 12, our neighborhood, my best friends across the street, we actually put on plays every week in the summertime.
Wow.
And the poor parents had to watch it all the time.
And act like they enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But so, actually, that's just how it started. And you find like you kind of have a knack for it, and you just keep going down that path, and it feels stronger and stronger, and that's how it started with me.
Yeah. How about you, David? What was your first introduction to this world of acting?
Well, I started pretty young, actually.
How young were you?
I was 6 or 7. My church did a production of The Music Man, and I was cast as one of the boys in the band.
Because you actually were a boy at that time.
Yes, I was legitimately a boy, and borrowed my cousin's trumpet. And
did you know how to play it?
No, oh, but of course they don't really.
Doesn't matter, right? Yeah.
They make a lot of noise. But I do remember saying to the director, because we had a recording of all of us playing terribly, and I said, why can't we just play our instruments and that would sound terrible? So I was already being a pain as an actor.
You wanted to be a director, as it turned out.
At 6 or 7. And then I did, skits and shows and things through grade school and junior high. I did speech tournaments. And then high school, I got into the theater there and forensics.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of people whose acting careers look a lot like what you've just described. They're in some plays when they're kids, they're in debate or speech when they're in high school. Mm-hmm. But something pushed you to keep doing this after other people decided, well, I've got to go get a quote unquote real job. What led you to stay in acting?
Well, I always loved it, and I actually held off sort of for a long time. I didn't major in theater when I was an undergrad. I had several majors. I went to Mizzou and was in the journalism school for a while, but I was doing plays throughout all that time. And I got an offer to go to grad school on a full ride scholarship at Wayne State University in Detroit for theater. And that was about the time that I thought, okay, well, if people are going to basically pay me to do this, then it's what I love to do.
How can you say no?
Exactly.
Kathleen Werfel, you also have been doing this a long time.
I have. I probably longer, a little bit more than these two.
Do you want to tell us how many years you've been an actor?
Oh, golly, I would have a hard time putting a number on it, but okay. I think probably over 35, I will say.
Yeah. When did you start?
Oh, professionally, I started in 1987.
Okay.
Really professionally, more like 1980, because I was working for the New Theater. But I started like these two when I was little. I had an interest that was not really encouraged, except for the musical portion, you know, because I'd sing in church, and that was very encouraged and all. But
I bet a lot of people get their start in church with their music and their acting.
Not
me.
Not you.
No.
You did not start in church. Jen wants to be clear about that. The church is not part of her story.
No. Well, one thing, I am not a singer, and Kathleen's a beautiful singer. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, Kathleen, what's the first thing you were in? Do you recall?
Lovely Hula Hands when I was 6 is what I auditioned for and didn't make.
I'm not familiar with that. Maybe it's not just my lack of knowledge of
Hawaiian
drama.
Piece?
It's a classic.
I think it was made up by one of my classmates who directed it and didn't cast me really, but I really tried. So I count that as my initiation into acting.
That should definitely be in your bio. So I guess I'm curious. You all are doing this in Kansas City, which means you've had to be in a lot of different kinds of things, I have to imagine, to make a living as actors in Kansas City. What are some of the things that you are most proud to have performed in this town? Jan?
One of my most challenging roles to this date is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and that was with Kansas City Actors Theater, and that was in 2007.
And what was so great about that production?
It's challenging. It's a very, very long play. You have to sustain the character for a very long time. And as David knows, because he's a little inebriated in this play.
Not right now, though. No,
not right now. In the play. But, you're drinking all night long. And it just is one of those plays where you can just dig deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's extremely challenging and difficult and awesome and...
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah, so. And such a classic. David, what's your what's a piece of work that you're most proud of in Kansas City?
I've been very lucky, actually. I have a lot of plays that I look back on very fondly. I think Death of a Salesman at the Rep was one of my favorites. And The Deputy at the Rep. Many shows at the Unicorn. And the Tally trilogy that we did with Kansas City Actors Theater, spent the summer doing the 3 Tally plays, was pretty awesome.
I think a lot of our listeners would recognize all 3 of you from roles they've seen you in at one place or another, The Rep or the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival. Or I think you all 3 of you are
yes.
pretty regular performers in the free Shakespeare productions out in the park. How about you, Kathleen? What's something you're most proud of?
Well, like David, I would have to say there are so many to pick from, and for different reasons. I remember and value them. Probably the most challenging would be Cat on a Hot Tin Roof at the Rep. I won't say it was my very favorite because it was my hardest, but it was the one probably I value the most. Not even the most. There's Cripple of Inishmutton, which I played a very small role in, but it was the inaugural production of KCAT, Kansas City Actors Theater, and it was one of the most beautifully done productions I've ever seen, even from backstage. I played another older woman like I do in this one, in that only she was quite, talk about inebriation, she was quite inebriated most of the time.
So funny. So funny with you and Gary Holcomb.
Oh, yes, Gary.
So this is the second mention of people playing playing drunk on the stage.
It's on our minds.
Right. It's so early in the morning, too. But you all have quite a rapport. You've actually worked together a fair amount. Is that right?
Yeah, we've all worked together many times, all three of us. But you guys have done Christmas Carol how many times?
We did it, I think, together as the Cratchits for about 12 years, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
When did you stop doing that? Have you stopped doing that?
Yes, I haven't done Christmas Carol for years now.
And so. I stopped doing it four years ago, maybe.
Okay. I'm not,
I think.
We've all done the Shakespeare Festival together in different roles, but I think we've done two or three productions.
With one that we were...
The Scottish play.
Right. And
Romeo and
Juliet.
Yeah. And interestingly, Jan and I did it twice. Were you in the first production, David?
No.
But Jan and I did it twice. Yeah. And the first time she played the nurse, I played
Lady Capulet.
And the next time, Jan played Lady Capulet, and I played the nurse.
Yeah.
Which says something about your versatility as actors, I suppose. And that's a pretty key part, I have to think, of having a long and successful acting career, especially in Kansas City. Am I right to make that assumption that you would have more opportunities if you lived somewhere else?
It's difficult to say. I think people don't realize what a wonderful theater town Kansas City is. For our size, we have so much theater going on. You really notice it when you go to other cities and realize there are really only two or three theaters going in major cities, some places. So
do we have here?
Oh, roughly. Off the hot top of my head, I'd have to say we have...
I would say I should know this because
because you've worked at most of them.
Well, no, actually, there are some I haven't.
A couple hundred?
There are at least 12, and I think there are more. Union houses.
Oh,
and
I'm speaking actors.
But at least a dozen union theaters.
And I think there are 14, if I'm, I think it's more than 12. So.
And then, but you said a couple hundred actors, Jan. Is there kind of a core group that stays around here year after year, and then others who come and go? How stable is the acting pool in Kansas?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think the young people come up from the universities. And we all have our eye on them because, you know, the directors want to cast the young people. Some of them go away and some of them stay. And that's when you get the new generation cropping up. Mm-hmm. But our generation here, we have been loyal to Kansas City for a long time. I left in 2000 and came back about 2009, 2010. I still worked here sporadically through that time. And there has been a wave. It's an ebb and flow. And mm-hmm. right now we are just exploding with theater, fantastic theater. A lot of actors are being employed. It's a real renaissance time, I think. Compared to St. Louis, St. Louis, they cannot hold professional actors there. They just don't have it there like that. So we're about the same size, aren't we?
I think UMKC has always been a huge influence on the Dr. McElrath, who started the
Kansas City
rep. Mm-hmm. And they always had a company of actors in their grad school, in particular, who would work in rep shows and with co-productions, would work at the Unicorn or work at the Coterie or work around town, and they would get to know people, and the people in town would get to know them, and a lot of them end up staying maybe for a few years till they get their equity card and they want to go off to Chicago or New York or whatever, and then some of them turn around and come back several years later. So it's a thriving community, and it's been great for me to see after all these years that it's still going strong.
You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about the acting scene and the life of an actor in Kansas City with David Fritz and Jan Rogge and Kathleen Warfel. They're all here because they're all in a production right now at the Kansas City Actors Theater that opens next week. It runs January 11th to 29th on City Stage at Union Station, called My Old Lady. Love to hear more about this play and what has drawn the three of you to it, and what a potential theater goer might expect. Kathleen, what's this play about?
Well, it's about a man, not a young man, I will say, a sort of middle-aged man who is looking to improve his life by taking advantage of an inheritance he has, and I don't want to give anything away.
Right, no spoilers.
So he comes to Paris and pursues that and finds his riches in other ways. That's what I'll
wow.
say.
Wow, now see, that, not only was that not a spoiler, that was just tantalizing.
Intriguing.
The three of you are the entire cast of this play by Israel Horowitz. And I understand this play hasn't been performed in Kansas City in, well, a long time, right?
A long time. The last time it was done was called Widow's Blind Date, and a little, tiny little theater that Sydney Garrett and I put together called Ground Zero Productions. It was a three-character play, much different than this play, but it was three characters, and David was in that play. So it was a long time ago, but it was a powerful little show. But yeah, he's prolific. Israel Horowitz has written 40, 50 plays, and yeah.
The play was made into a movie just a couple of years ago that Israel Horowitz actually directed, as I understand. And they had Maggie Smith
adapted,
and Kevin
yeah.
Kline. Does doing a show that maybe some of your audience has seen as a movie change anything for you about how you produce it or how they receive it?
I don't know as far as the audience goes. I know that I tend to avoid seeing films. I did.
Don't want to do a Kevin Kline impersonation by mistake.
Well, either. It's just, it can get in your head a little bit, good and bad. Mm-hmm. You know, every interpretation is different because it's got different actors and different directors. And, you know, that's why we're still doing Hamlet all these years later, because every production is different. Even if you know the play, it can turn out, you know, a lot differently watching it. So I always try to avoid that. I'll watch them after. We did Bus Stop years ago at the Rep, and I hadn't seen that movie in years, and it was happened to be on cable, and I recorded it, but I waited till afterwards to watch it, and I got about half an hour into it and said, I can't watch this. it was too close to my heart at that point.
Too close meaning you didn't like the artistic choices they were making, or you wished you had made other choices?
Honestly, I didn't like the I liked the movie a lot less after having worked on the play.
Interesting.
Granted, it was done in the 50s and there was a different take on it, but
Picnic was like that too.
Yes. Yeah.
The
yes.
film
yeah.
Picnic.
Mm-hmm. We did Picnic with Kansas City Actors Theater a few years ago, and it was the same thing. They happened to be running the movie around the same time, and I recorded it, but I got about half an hour into it the week yeah. after we closed, and I couldn't watch it.
Yeah, I know I said this already, but the three of you have quite a rapport from the time you've spent working together and knowing each other all these years. Is it like that more broadly in the Kansas City acting community? Is there a sense that everybody sort of knows each other?
I think in a broad sense, yes. I know a lot of people. There are a lot of new people I don't, though. A lot I'm just surprised by. There are many, many I have not worked with. But I would say of those of us that are of a certain age, we've worked together. And we appreciate each other's talents and value the opportunity that we're given to work with
Yeah, because it's
each
not,
other.
Like you said, it's not just that we know each other and we're of that age range and experience, but we want to work together. And there's a core of us. And so what we have the opportunity to do, it's really special. And if we worked outside the city, you work with people you don't know all the time. it's really nice. It's kind of a second family. So,
yeah.
If you're listening at home and you want to ask a question of our guests today about the acting scene in Kansas City or their own experiences in particular shows, maybe even something you've seen, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can speak with David Fritz and Jan Rogge and Kathleen Worfel here on KCUR's Up to Date. You know, Kathleen, you mentioned all of the young actors, some, including some you don't even know at this point. Is Kansas City a good training ground? We mentioned all of these theaters, which means there's work for actors. But is this a place people come to really get their feet wet in the business, or do they have to go away to learn and come back here?
I hesitate to speak for them, but I think so. I think it's a great place to get started. I know there are a lot of those people, like, oh, well, we've got Rusty Sneary with The Living Room. We've got Vanessa Severo, who works a lot. There are so many young talents who have decided to make this place their home. And so it's not just a place to get your feet wet. It, because of the amount of theaters here, both professional and non-professional, that are very quality, it's just a great way for the young actor to learn. I mean, you've got people of all ages and some incredible directors, some wonderful spaces that range a great variety of types of theaters. So
it's really changed with UMKC. When I was there, we didn't have this co-production. Well, okay, that was a long time ago.
We didn't ask you how many years it was, but all right.
But now the theater community is really embracing them for numerous reasons. They do co-productions, UMKC, with The Coterie, The Unicorn, maybe a little bit of Heart of America Shakespeare Festival, but definitely Kansas City Actors Theater. And we're even going to have more of a relationship with UMKC next year.
Very good. Well, let's take a couple of calls from some of our listeners who are chomping at the bit to ask you all questions. Let's talk first to Frank in Lawrence, who called 816-235-2888. Hi, Frank.
Thanks. Good morning. Yeah, I've seen some plays in Kansas City. They're really fantastic. My question has to do with the equity card. Sounds like a union card. How long does it take to get it, what you need to do to get it, and I've heard mentioned once you get it, you go to Chicago. What's the value of the card, and how do you get it, and what's after that?
Kathleen?
Well, I'm kind of on the spot here. You usually work for a number of weeks in order to achieve your union status, and some people choose not to do it for very good reasons. Some people decide that this is how they're going to make their living forever. And really, I mean, for my buck, I'll just put my little 2 cents is really what it is, not a buck. I will say that if you're wanting to do it professionally, you have the opportunity for insurance and pension and all.
And it guarantees you certain wages. I mean,
Absolutely guarantees you a certain wage depending on what contract you work.
You said you have to work a certain number of weeks before you get it. Do you have to sort of already be succeeding in the business before you're going to get the card?
Well, weeks in a professional theater, actually. The term is, and I should feel embarrassed, the term's escaping me right now, but you can sort of apprentice.
Yeah.
Like an internship? Or
no.
Well, usually if a professional theater hires you and you're a non-equity person, you accrue weeks toward getting your equity card. Mm. A theater can also just give you an equity contract and turn you equity on the spot.
That's true.
I see.
You have to pay a certain amount to get in, which was incredibly cheap when I did it.
And not so now.
And not so much now. But you pay that initial, and then once you become a professional.
But it's the mark that you're in the business.
Right. And it guarantees certain working conditions, certain, you know, it's a union. It gives you protection as far as salaries go, things like that, the amount of work they can expect of you in a week.
Working conditions.
Yeah.
You know, that's really why it started
like,
so long
like
ago.
Like a lot of unions would do.
Right.
Let's take another call from Kelly in Westwood. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I was wondering how much, if you're making a living as an actor, how much voiceovers, commercials, small films, that sort of thing factor into making an overall living?
Right. Good question. I mean, we're talking with folks who have done the rare thing of making a living as an actor, but it isn't all just one easy job after another. That's not how it works, right, Jen?
No, I mean, that's a great question. And hopefully you're able to fill that gap with commercials. Voiceovers is a really small part of it. It's great if you can get in it, but I know people that do voiceovers, and once they do it, they just keep getting called back and forth, you know, over and over. So you can get in that door. That's great. More and more films are being done here. Yes. Kathleen has been in many of them. And I know David, too. You just did that great lotto commercial. That was great.
That was this summer. Yeah, it's part of the whole process. We do play readings. We do commercial work when we can get it, film work when you can get it. So it's that certainly helps.
Have any of you had to do work that has nothing to do with acting to get through?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
I worked at the zoo.
Yeah, well, that sounds like fun. And I won't say that that's a lot like working with other actors.
I did have to work with other actors. We were set in Australia in the outback, and I know I had to say g'day, g'day, g'day all the time.
How about you guys? What have you done besides act?
Oh.
Is this rude to ask these questions of actors?
No, I mean, that's part of the deal. And I think if you don't realize that as starting off as a, particularly if you're focusing on theater, because, you know, it can pay well, but you're not doing it 52 weeks a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can get three or four shows in a year, that's excellent. And that's approximately 6 weeks per show. So, you know, you're looking at maybe 30 weeks and that leaves
a lot of time
open.
So what have you done,
well,
Kathleen?
Oh, I've done the commercial and a small amount of voiceover. And then I teach.
You teach?
As well. And I've done several films.
What do you teach?
Acting, coaching.
Very good.
You know, so I've done a few different things, from a mask class to dialect, actually, which I felt a little uncomfortable with. But
in fact, last semester we all coached at Blue Valley.
Yes, yes, North. All three of us. That's
which
right.
Blue Valley, which I know North. Has a much, much respected drama program.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Program. Let's take one more call from Beth in Prairie Village. Hi, Beth.
Hello. How are you?
Doing well. What are you thinking about today, Beth?
Well, I wanted to say that I'm on the very outskirts of the theater groups here, but the Kansas City area is well-respected throughout the country in all the theater that we have here. And my little anecdote is I get in the cab in L.A., and the cab driver said, oh, you're from Kansas City? Well, how's theater? And he's going on and on about the different theaters, and he presented his play to the Unicorn to see if he could get it produced. So there is a lot going on here, and the world is aware of Kansas City theater. And that's really all I wanted to say.
Well, that is a good place perhaps for us to end this conversation.
Fantastic.
That,
thank you.
Theater is alive
thank
and
you
well.
Very much.
Thank you so much, Beth. And we should mention one more time that all of our guests, David Fritz, Jan Rogge, and Kathleen Warfel, are appearing in the Kansas City Actors Theater production of My Old Lady. It runs the 11th through the 29th of this month on City Stage at Union Station. It's been good to have you all here. Thanks for sharing your stories
you.
With us.
Can I just put
so
a
much.
Plug for Wayside Waves? If you put Wayside said waves in your code, they get 25% off with the tickets.
Oh, very good to know.
25% for them.
Very good. I appreciate you all being here. Coming up, when we come back, we'll talk about incarceration and whether it may be unnecessary as populations are growing in Missouri and Kansas prisons. Stay with us. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. If you missed our show yesterday, we did a legislative preview of both the Missouri and Kansas legislative sessions. You can find that online at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the ethics professors return to discuss recent newsworthy moral dilemmas. You'll want to be here for that. Missouri Governor-elect Eric Greitens campaigned on a platform of cracking down on violence and being tough on crime. He's called for tougher sentences for those who assault police officers, and just yesterday here in Kansas City told a group of them he has their back. But meanwhile, as the Missouri General Assembly convenes in Jeff City in about 20 minutes, among the many bills legislators will consider is one sponsored by a Republican former sheriff's deputy that would actually eliminate mandatory minimum sentences for many nonviolent crimes and guarantee parole hearings for all but the most heinous offenses. That is probably a good idea, according to our guest today, Lauren Brooke Eisen. She's senior counsel at the Brennan Center's Justice Program at New York University's School of Law. She co-authored a report that says there are more than 500,000 people behind bars in America with no compelling reason. Lauren Brooke Eisen, welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad you're here. So let me start with what seems obvious enough, but maybe is more complicated. Why, in theory, do we put people in prison at all?
Well, we have used incarceration. We have used our jails. We've used our prisons, since the country was founded. However, it's gotten much more complicated because our prison population today of 2.2 million people incarcerated behind in jails and in prisons is one of the largest our country has ever seen. And there are various reasons for incarcerating someone, but what we are doing in most situations is merely incapacitating people. So what we're doing is punishing them for committing a crime for many, many years, and often in rural areas very far from their families.
And so we're punishing them. Is that different than what the historic or ideal reason for putting people in prison would be?
Well, there are various reasons. So there's this idea of deterrence, right, that if someone knows what their punishment is, if they're afraid of their punishment, they won't commit crimes. There's been a lot of research over the past decades indicating that deterrence actually has very little impact on why someone does or does not commit a crime, especially considering how complicated our sentencing structures are. You know, someone may not know when a mandatory minimum is triggered or how long this judge is more inclined to give. Deterrence really is not very effective.
So what then is the actual impact of putting people in prison? In what sense is it true that, as you say, too many people are behind bars?
Well, today, with 2.2 million people incarcerated in this country, we are well past the point of incarcerating only those people who may be more dangerous, right, who may need some time, behind bars to receive rehabilitation or programming. We're incarcerating a lot of lower-level offenders, people who, may have been convicted of possessing drugs or, petty theft. And because we are incarcerating so many Americans today, we've done a lot of research on this, at the Brennan Center and a lot of very smart people over the last 3 to 4 decades. And it turns out that, in fact, incarceration may be what's called criminogenic. And what that means is that if you're incarcerating, especially these lower-level offenders, they may learn, more criminal tendencies while they're behind bars. They're not necessarily receiving the programming and the interventions that they need, that may get at why they committed a crime in the first place. And then what we do is we release these people, with $5 on a bus ticket, and they have a hard time finding jobs because they have a criminal record. They've been away from their families, their communities, and it's very hard to reenter their communities.
So your research, though, and your carefully arrived at conclusions supported by data, seems like it runs into headlong into conflict with, frankly, what political winds are blowing and what people seem to want. Most politicians who are elected at some point voice a tough-on-crime platform. Isn't that what people want, to see more people behind bars if they commit crimes?
That's not, in fact, true. So, yes, you're right that for many years, policymakers have been seen as tough on crime. It's been very hard to get elected as a prosecutor, as a state legislator, as a federal legislator, if you were seen as soft on crime. But over the past years, with this additional research and understanding of what actually reduces crime in this country, a lot of politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, have really started to understand that more incarceration does not, in fact, make us safer. Republicans like Speaker Paul Ryan, Senators Mike Lee and John Cornyn and others have strongly backed criminal justice reform. And in fact, many efforts in the states were led by conservative lawmakers. So we are seeing a momentum of both Republican and Democratic policymakers pushing, what's considered smart on crime policies, policies that would actually make it possible for those who have violated a criminal law to receive an alternative to incarceration instead of long prison sentences.
Well, it is a Republican here in Missouri who has pre-filed House Bill 38. We should note that there are dozens and dozens of bills that get pre-filed in the Missouri General Assembly that never really see the light of day. But this one may have some traction. It would reduce mandatory minimums, make the sentencing guidelines more just guidelines, and encourage more use of parole and probation. Generally speaking, Lauren Brooke Eisen, what do you think of that?
Eliminating mandatory minimums is certainly a very significant first step in right-sizing our prison populations. This report indicates that almost 40% of Americans of our total prison population are unnecessarily behind bars. Many of these people are serving time for mandatory minimum penalties. And certainly a use of probation and parole is seen as a much smarter way of supervising someone than sending someone to prison where they're not going to receive the programming and the interventions that they need. So if someone is on probation, if they're on parole, and they're able to earn money for their families and continue to go to school and drive their children to school and continue to work, all of the research indicates that they're going to be much more productive citizens. And so certainly any sort of bill that encourages a use of probation and parole in lieu of incarceration is a huge step in the right direction.
But you say it's only a first step.
Well, so this report focuses on changing the laws. And we suggest in this report, we recommend that for many lower-level crimes, that the default sanction should be a non-incarceration sanction.
So how are you defining a lower-level crime?
So in the report, we looked at some of the nonviolent lower-level crimes, such as property offenses under $10,000, drug possession, even lower-level lower-level property and drug crimes, vice crimes. And, the idea is that people who commit these crimes, if you just look at the elements of the crimes, prison is not the best place for them. And the report notes, of course, there are always exceptional circumstances, and judges should continue to be able to use discretion in a lot of situations. But that prison is really not the right place for so many people who are there today. So our report indicates that 25% of prisoners, almost all nonviolent, would be better served by these alternatives to incarceration, such as treatment, community service, or probation. And interestingly enough, we also found that about 212,000 inmates have already served sufficiently long prison terms and could likely be released within the next year with little risk to public safety. And those people who have already served sufficiently long prison terms are there for more serious crimes, such as murder and assault. And our findings indicate that because they have served such long sentences, they are not likely getting any sort of benefits at this point. They're likely not going to be able to reduce their recidivism at this point.
Yeah. Now, if reducing minimum sentences it would have a negative political consequence, I have to think a platform that supported releasing convicted murderers sooner would have an even more drastic response. I mean, I'm thinking of the Willie Horton ad that sunk Michael Dukakis's presidential campaign, the person who committed a murder while he was out on a weekend furlough. And I'm thinking, what politician would support this? Is this just sort of a theoretical report, or do you think this could really happen?
You know, it's not theoretical. So a lot of research backs up our findings here. And the research indicates that long lengths of stay can actually increase recidivism in many cases. And the reason for that is because if someone spends 10, 20 years behind bars, you know, even 5 years in some situations, and they're not receiving the interventions, the treatment, the drug treatment that they need, the, you know, mental health counseling that they need, how does that improve public safety at all? And in most of the prisons in this country, there are very long lines and waiting lists to get into a lot of the programming that exists. There's just not enough rehabilitative programming in prisons across the country. And a lot of these people are, you know, at a certain point, they're just not improving public safety. The longer, you know, the further apart they, that the more time they spend behind bars away from their families, away from their communities, away from their support networks, you know, the more unsafe our communities will be.
And I guess the other question I have, just from a financial realism standpoint, I mean, you've mentioned treatment programs and community service and probation. This would require a pretty substantial increase in staffing and investment, right?
It would, however, it's very expensive to incarcerate someone. So I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the statistics that it can oftentimes, and in many cases, cost more to send someone to Harvard for 1 year. It can actually cost more to send someone to prison for a year than it can to send them to Harvard. And that's a pretty amazing statistic. Incarceration is very, very expensive. And our report indicates that we would see substantial cost savings by applying these recommendations to our prison population. So if these prisoners were released, it could save about $20 billion annually and $200 billion over 10 years. And we could use that money to reinvest in communities. We could hire more police officers. We could hire more school teachers. There's just so much we could do with that money. And you're right, programming is expensive, but it's still a lot cheaper than incarceration.
Is anyone actually trying this anywhere? Are there particular states or maybe even other countries that model the kind of system that you would advocate?
Absolutely. So a lot of states have reduced their prison population and crime, which is pretty significant. In fact, over the last decade, 27 states have reduced crime and incarceration. New York is one of those states. New York reformed its Rockefeller drug laws that kept people in prison for very long mandatory minimums for possession of drugs. And recently Kentucky and South Carolina have experimented with something called justice reinvestment, which focuses on improving public safety by increasing resources sent to probation and parole and even reducing some mandatory minimums and eliminating mandatory minimums. In fact, South Carolina was so successful at reforming some of its sentencing policies that they were able to close prisons, which is pretty significant.
Well, it sounds like something that Missouri and Kansas lawmakers will at least have to consider, and we'll be following that if they do. Lauren Brooke Eisen is senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program. She joined us by phone from New York City. Lauren Brooke, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, our local listen. And Bill Brownlee is here with this week's Local Listen. Happy New Year, Bill.
Same to you, Brian.
It's good to see you again, and I'm pretty excited. We're featuring a gospel group this time around, Isaac Cates and Ordained.
We're going to all need to put on our church clothes, Brian.
Well, I actually have some of those, so that'll be all right. these guys have been around for quite a while, I guess.
Yes, Isaac Cates and Ordained are one of Kansas City's most notable black gospel groups. They're a tremendous ensemble, and they have a big show Friday at a local church.
Is there a big gospel scene here in Kansas City?
There's so much talent, but most of it's limited to Sunday mornings. Only a handful of ensembles, including Isaac Cates, make the attempt to establish a presence both locally and nationally among secular listeners.
Well, we have our listeners. I won't assume they are secular, but I will at least allow them to take a listen. Let's hear a little from Isaac Cates and Ordained.
I know that sometimes life can really beat you down, and it gets so hard, but we want to encourage you. God's grace is sufficient for you. You're gonna make it.
When I am weak, God, you are strong. You're all I need. So I surrender it all to you. 'Cause you are enough for me.
That is the sound of a man who can sing.
He can sing, and he means it. I asked Isaac, you know, what the genesis of the song was. He said he wrote it while he was in the hospital.
Wow.
So, you know, he's...
So when you sing about God's provision, you believe it.
That's right. He was inspired by a verse about, you know, God's grace being sufficient. And, you know, the hardship that this is rooted in is it obviously shows...
Yeah, there, just even the musical elements of it as well, apart from the words, are of the highest level. He's not just a lay singer, right?
No, he's not a lay singer, and he's also a tremendous pianist. There's outstanding musicianship across the board, and you know that choir truly is heavenly.
Yeah, and they've shared the stage with some pretty great gospel names, right?
Right. They've opened for Shirley Caesar, and then they've previously opened for Marvin Sapp, which is the reason for Friday's concert.
Yeah, tell us about Friday's concert. They're opening for Marvin Sapp. Where at?
They're at the Victorious Life Church at 3400 Paseo, and it's a Martin Luther King event hosted by the Southern Leadership Conference.
What's your favorite part of this song we're hearing?
I like the slow build. You know, this song goes on for 5 or 6 minutes, and you know it starts with that testimony, and it builds into a glorious release.
Let's listen to just a little more there. Love the Hammond B3 organ in there too.
Yeah, everything about this is spot on. This is kind of, you know, for me, the Kansas City gospel version of Stairway to Heaven.
That's our contributor, Bill Brownlee, talking with us about Isaac Cates and Ordained. That's You Are Enough. Bill, always good to see you. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
You can listen to all of today's show and to our previous programs. You can download our podcasts, too, at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow, join us for the ethics professors who come back to talk about the latest in the news and in moral dilemmas. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Coy Duggar. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.